This episode is sponsored by Indeed. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes of this show, booking guests across time zones, tight turnaround edits, and constant time management. And when things get chaotic, you realize pretty quickly how important it is to have the right person on your team. If I had to hire someone tomorrow, I wouldn't just want a good editor. I'd want someone who understands pace in long-form interviews and can work fast under pressure. And in moments like that, you think, this is a job for sponsored jobs. Because Indeed sponsored jobs boost your listing in search results, helping you reach the candidates with the specific skills and experience you actually need. And it works. Sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 95% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs. That's a serious edge when the pressure's on. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. When you need the right person to cut through the chaos, this is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? This is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. Cadillac has entered Formula One, deepening the racing pedigree behind every V-Series on the road. Discover a lineup that delivers pure adrenaline in the form of modern luxury. Experience the quickest Cadillac ever, the all-electric Lyriq V, the peak performance of the CT5V Blackwing, the nimble agility of the Optiq V, and the legendary roar of the Escalade V, all engineered to thrill. Find out more about Cadillac's performance story in Formula One and our race-tested V-Series lineup at Cadillac.com.
This year, experience the NHL playoffs your way. Want to watch a single? Do or die Game 7, a full week of heavy-hitting back-and-forth series. Then check out Sling's 1-3 and 7-day passes. Watch the chase for the cup on ESPN and TNT, starting as low as $4.99. No long-term contracts or overpaying. Just live hockey at home or when you want it. Sling lets you do that. Visit sling.com to learn more.
Haas have started the new era of Formula One in style. So is it too early to talk about loftier ambitions?
For me to sit here and talk about the wins is too far away. So our medium-term target in the next 3 to 5 years is basically trying to establish ourselves consistently at the front of the midfield pack. Only when you get there, then we can look at, okay, what are we still lacking to challenge for podiums on the merit, to challenge for the race wins on the merit.
And if Ollie Bearman continues to impress, can Haas keep hold of him?
If we've done great job with Ollie, and then Ollie performed so well that Ferrari really wants to take him the following year, we have to be happy that we've done our job.
Hello and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid. I'm Tom Clarkson and my guest this week is Haas team principal Ayo Komatsu. Ayo's only been in charge of the team since 2024, but what I think comes across in our chat is how much of a natural leader he is. He empowers people, he listens to them, and he makes the right calls when necessary. Just look at how the team recovered from a very difficult start to last season. We talk a lot about drivers. What does Ayo expect from Esteban Ocon this season? How much potential does Ollie Bearman have? I also ask Ayo about his relationship with team owner Gene Haas, in whom he saw a different side at last year's Goodwood Festival of Speed, where both of them drove a Haas F1 car up the famed hill climb. Ayo's been with Haas since their debut season in 2016, and I think it's clear to see how much this team means to him. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Ayo, welcome to the show. 2 years on since your last appearance.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. It's great to be back.
Well, should I be afraid, first of all? Because I saw some very interesting pre-season preparation for you, I think, on Instagram. What were you up to?
No, because we signed a new sponsor in Thailand, Singha Beer. And so we went to Bangkok straight after Bahrain to announce the partnership. And then they're a great company, and then they sponsor Muay Thai fighters, world champions. And then I don't do Muay Thai properly, but I just like doing the training. So I said to them, is there any chance I can train with one of your fighters? And then they kindly put me with a Super Bomb, who is an absolute legend. So what a privilege to train with a raging world champion.
So Muay Thai is kickboxing?
It's a Thai kickboxing, but I think kickboxing. I think if you say to Muay Thai guys it's kickboxing, they get offended because Muay Thai has a clinching. I think kickboxing is just punches and kicks, but now it's a great. Jim had a great vibe. I mean, he's been doing Muay Thai since the age of six, and he's 36 now, world champion. And he's got great gym, really humble guy, amazing. It's always nice to get to know somebody who's at the top of their game.
Quite good to have that in your back pocket in the Formula One paddock, right? If anyone annoys Ayo Komatsu, watch
out. Not
that good. Well, Ayo, as I said at the top, it's been a couple of years since you were last on the show. Tell us, how has it gone since then?
No, of course, it's been a roller coaster of a ride, but overall, I really, really enjoyed it. It's such a privilege. We got, as I said from day one, I knew you had a great bunch of people. We got great people. So it was really a matter of putting it together, working as a team, support each other, having a clear objective and the strategy, how we're going to move the team forward. So every day, honestly, I'm learning something new. And then it's every day is a challenge, but in a good way. It's brilliant. I really enjoy it. But honestly, only because of the people we got. I think we're building a really nice team here.
You say you're learning something every day. What is the biggest lesson you have learned in 2 years of being a team principal?
Biggest lesson? It's difficult to say because honestly, there's so many things, but I guess listen, really, you know, because I feel like my job is a facilitator. You know, I'm not executing anything, right? So we have a group of individuals, group of people who's really, really capable, expert in each area, but sometimes they cannot do the job to their best of ability or because of certain constraints, but I need to listen to them, right? They need to be able to tell me what's stopping them to perform better to go to the next step. And I feel like my job is really to provide an environment so they can do an even better job. So for instance, I think last 2 years, we managed to develop the car very, very well throughout the season. That's one thing we really wanted to prove. We knew we could do it, but before pre-24, let's say, you know, people are telling us that, you know, Haas cannot develop the car throughout the season. You know, we proved that's completely wrong. And then that gives us lots of confidence to the people. But again, only way we manage to do it is really to empower the people, those technical people, then listen to them. They need to tell me, like, you know, why they couldn't develop it before. Then when they told me, it was actually the same as my understanding. So it was pretty then clear to me what I needed to put in place to make sure that we can develop the car.
So it really helps that you are an engineer by trade because you can understand the weaknesses.
It's not actually necessarily the engineering thing, to be honest, because the issue wasn't the technical ability. That wasn't the one actually stopping us developing a car pre-24. It was more about communication, organization, the structure, mentality, you know, rule of engagement, how we work together. So once I understood, let's say if this group of people tells me, oh, we saw this was the issue. This group of people tells me, no, we saw this was the issue. Why was they not aligned? You know, they're both technically capable people. But somehow, it's just that they weren't working together on the same page. So for me, really just making sure, you know, put everybody on the same page. We are aligned, regardless of if everybody agrees or not. We at least we go into a certain direction, knowing why we're going that way. You know, for me, it's very, very important that everybody understands why we're doing things that we are doing, even if you don't agree. You know, worst thing would be like everybody thinking, I don't understand why we're doing this. No idea this is a waste of time. Why are we doing this? You know, having that, you know, every day, that's not very positive, is it? Whereas if you don't agree the direction we're going, if you know at least why, yeah, then that's still positive.
How have you improved this communication? I think it's really interesting. Are you now overseeing what, weekly meetings with everybody that wasn't happening before? Or is Andrea Desordo doing that? Or
yeah, again, like everybody is doing it because again, Andrea is our technical director, great guy. Honestly, since almost the first day I met him in my previous position, in his previous position, I knew he was a great guy. He's technically highly capable, of course, but in terms of personality, he is very, very easy to work with. And then he takes, let's say, constructive criticism very, very well. He never takes things personally, which is very important. You know, we got to be able to have hard conversations, difficult conversations, right? But if people are taking it personally, it's not easy. But Andrea, I know that you can discuss anything with him completely professionally, and there's no, let's say, emotion in a bad sense. You know, sometimes people say, I get really upset because only because I care. But to me, that's an excuse. You know, we're all professional, so we got to be able to really have hard conversation without taking it personally. And Andrea can do that, and he's a great communicator. And he's, again, very humble guy, really eager to learn every day. So, yeah, he's a great technical director. But in terms of communication, it's not about doing meetings. It's more about, let's say, setting a clarity. Everybody got to know the objectives, right? What are we here for? What are we trying to target? Then everybody got to understand, okay, in terms of global strategy, how are we going to try to achieve that target? In order to achieve those targets, how are we going to work together? You know, then in terms of putting people in the right place, like Andrea being technical director for me, that was absolutely no-brainer. He was a clear choice for me. Then having certain people in certain positions and a slight reorganization in terms of structure so that this communication is almost forced. It has to happen. This cross-loop has to happen. So it's just, putting people in the right place and slight restructuring that really sort of like supports what we're trying to do.
And this is why you reorganized the engineering teams
yes.
at the racetrack at the start of last year as well?
Yes and no. But initially, obviously the car comes from, let's say, factory, right? You know, so the truck side team is largely a user. So our, let's say, fundamental problem that was that a car wasn't competitive. But now we reorganized those technical people in Italy that we can produce a decent car. Then it was pretty clear operationally at the truck side, we are not getting best out of the car. We are not providing good enough feedback to our designers, aerodynamicists to improve the car. So then we really needed to refresh our truck side team. And the reason we did it last year was that, of course, we knew that 2026 would be brand new regulation. You know, you cannot, or you can, but I didn't want to make a wholesale change on the truck side when we have to deal with a brand new regulation. So for me, the last year was the correct time to do it. And then again, it's just accepting and understanding that, okay, we are a very young team here. This truck side team is young. We lack experience. So again, there's lots of support required from all sorts of directions. But as long as we accept that this is why we're doing it, we have to go through the pain together, then we have to put ourselves in a better position for this year and next year. And I do believe that even though we got a young team at the truck side, I think we got good people, so it will come.
Now, this segues beautifully into something I wanted to ask you about next, which is that week between Melbourne and China last year.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to bring back bad memories, I think it defines your leadership beautifully, because you come to Melbourne in 2025 and the car is like half a second slower than anything else.
Yep.
It was a really difficult weekend.
Yes.
Then you go to China just 7 days later and Oli Bearman is only a couple of tenths off getting into Q3. How did you do that turnaround and how difficult were those conversations in that 7 day period?
Yeah, that was a very, very difficult moment, you know, because Bahrain testing, as far as we are concerned, went pretty well. You know, so we thought car was decent. We didn't see any huge issues. Then come to Melbourne here in the high-speed chicane, car just wasn't performing. When I first saw the data, I thought, okay, it's a fast couple of laps, driver just taking it extremely easy. But then when I realized, you know, that is the limit of this car. And when I realized the extent of this problem, that we only saw it here in Melbourne, FP1, honestly made me feel sick. Because, like you said, it wasn't just a tenth or a few tenths. It was like six tenths. It was bad. then it's not something we anticipated whatsoever. So it was a surprise to us. But of course, initially it was a shock, right? But then you had to quickly come to acceptance to say, okay, we've got a huge issue here. Then first step is to really to understand what the issue is, what the core problem is. Then agree amongst the senior engineers, at least, what the problem is. You know, if we are arguing about what the problem is, no, this is actually not the problem. This is the issue. That is the issue. That's not good, right? So first step is to align everyone. What is the problem? Then once we accept it straight away, this is the fundamental aerodynamic issue that we didn't anticipate, but this is the issue. And then we didn't understand the mechanism. So next step is like, okay, how are we going to go about understanding the mechanism? But we haven't got much time. Now I said to everyone, like next weekend, back to back in China, we cannot change the car. But circuit characteristic is very different. So if we don't have this specific issue, I believe from what we saw in Bahrain, we can still perform. However, the race after in Japan, 3 weeks time, it's got that sector one high-speed sequence. If we don't change anything, we're going to be absolutely nowhere, basically last by country margin. So we cannot accept that. I said to do nothing for Japanese Grand Prix in 3 weeks time is not an option. That is very, very clear. But then also, I said to them, look, to bring something to Japan, we cannot go through the normal process because we just simply hasn't got time, right? To do CFD, you do the wind tunnel testing, evaluate, then produce the parts, we run out of time. So I said, I take the risk, I accept the risk, but please look back from the end of 24 where you guys produced a very, very competitive car to where we are now, VF25 launch. There must be some hint at some point that we are a bit complacent on certain matrix in terms of our air oscillation issues. So we got to be able to find some hint, and then I leave it to your engineering judgment because you're all capable people who managed to develop the head out of VF24, right? Finished essentially the fifth fastest car in 24. So we are the same people. You're the same people. We can do it. So look through those sequences and then take your best engineering guesstimate and then have one or two items that we can bring to Suzuka. And if we got it right in Suzuka, brilliant. You know, we know that's the direction to solve, we can keep going. But even if we get it wrong, at least we know that's not the direction to go. Because if we don't do anything, we're not going to learn anything. We're going to be in exactly the same position as here in Melbourne. So I said, that's not an option. But then, of course, being a former engineer, right, I really wanted to ask questions about how about looking at this? How about looking at this area? How about this? But I really, really forced myself not to do any of that. After I set that clear, let's say, guideline, okay, this is the problem. Look through this. Option not to do anything in Suzuka is not an option. Then I take a risk, fine, to cut corners. So you guys just tell me one or two things we can do in Suzuka. I just left it at that. And that was very, very difficult. Very difficult. But I'm so glad afterwards that I just shut up and didn't say anything after that. And then our guys, Andrea Di Zolto, our technical director, head of aero, Davide, they came to me and said, Ayao, we look through all this and we think this and this. What do you think? I said, if you think that, just go ahead. Then trying to make it. Now we got one set made for FP1. The second set was coming for FP2, if I remember correctly. We did a back-to-back across the cars, night and day. So, you know, full credit to them. But I'm really glad that I didn't micromanage. I just trusted them and then empowered them to say, look, this is the direction. Risk is on me. Go for it. And then full credit to them. They did it. It was brilliant. So I was really, really pleased about that in terms of teamwork. There was no blame. Everyone accepted the problem straight away, got on with it, found the solution. And then production guys, program management guys, they pushed like hell to get those parts to Suzuka from race one to race three. So that really is a testament to the teamwork, I think. And then I'm really glad that, you know, when the times are tough, that we come together really strongly. And then I'm kind of glad that that happened in 25, not 24. So i.e. the 12 months after, you know, we started this new structure, right? Imagine if that happens in 24 race one, I think we'd have disintegrated. But
why?
Because I think, so throughout 24, we were building foundations, right? you know, new way of doing things, working together, teamwork, supporting each other, transparency, no blame culture. So we are building those foundations. So by the time we hit that huge issue in Melbourne, at least we had that foundation. We had that respect and trust to each other. So when we're having those meetings in Melbourne late at night, when Europe wakes up with all the senior guys, we all been working together previous 12 months in this way. So there's no blame culture. Everybody understood that, okay, we just got to work together to solve this, no bullshit. But imagine if that happened in 24 March, where we only started working in this way a couple of months. I don't think we'd have had that level of togetherness and trust and respect to each other. So in a blessing in disguise that we had the 12 months to build that foundation, and then that huge challenge was there. And then that made us, you know, the fact that we came out on the other side in a good way, in the process is so important, right? You cannot control the result quite often, but you can definitely control the process. And I do believe that we did it in the right process, right way. So then the fact that was positive gave us even more confidence, like, wow, yes, initial bit was terrible that we missed it somewhere along the development of 25. But once we accepted we missed it, it's no point crying about it, right? So that's happened. We just, how are we going to improve from here? Everybody focused on that.
And you kicked on from there. And then fast forward 6-7 months.
Yeah.
And Ollie Bearman finishes P4 in Mexico on merit.
Yes.
In front of a McLaren.
Yes.
And a Mercedes.
That was amazing.
And the seeds of that performance. Yeah. Actually were sown in the 3 weeks between Melbourne and Suzuka earlier in the year. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I still remember that Melbourne or last year, 12 months ago, very, very well, because none of us slept much, right? You know, that, of course, here at the track until curfew, you're looking at data and then we're trying to understand what's going, go back to the hotel. We're now doing a video meeting with the guys back in Italy because Europe wakes up. So we're just working around the clock, you know, using the time differences because we just didn't have any time to waste. It was very, very tough. I don't wish that I want to experience that again. But looking back now, I can say now, because we solved it, that probably the challenge we had to overcome as a team, as a group of people, that really made the team even much, much stronger. It was brilliant. And also the confidence.
Almost a defining moment.
Sure,
actually, sure. Is what it sounds like. And Io, it's fascinating on many levels. You empowered the technical team to come up with a solution after Melbourne. And I think that's very revealing about your relationship with Gene Haas, the team owner, because clearly he's empowering you to take those risks.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm very, very grateful to be given, you know, this opportunity and also the trust Gene had in me. Of course, it was a huge risk for him, right? I'm not some sort of a known quantity, done a team principal job somewhere else before, but his judgment was that he only chose me because I was here from day one. I knew the people, I knew the strengths and weakness of the team. And then I'm sure that was gamble for him. Okay, this guy, he's not a known quantity, but he's been here from day one. He knows the people. He seems to know what's the weakness and strengths of the organization inside out. So let's give him a chance. So, you know, he took that risk. You know, and then he trusts me to run it with the guys. So yeah, I'm very grateful about that.
This episode is sponsored by Vanta. Now, if you run a business, one thing you might have noticed is how seriously companies now have to take security and compliance. Customers increasingly want proof that their data is protected before they'll even consider working with you. That's exactly the kind of challenge Vanta is built to solve. Vanta automates the compliance process and brings compliance, risk, and customer trust together on one AI-powered platform. So whether you're preparing for a SOC 2 or managing a larger enterprise GRC program, Vanta helps keep everything organized and running smoothly. And it can save a huge amount of time too. Companies like Ramp and Writer spend 82% less time on audits with Vanta. That's not just faster compliance. It's more time to focus on growing the business. Get started at vanta.com/grid. That's vanta.com/grid. This episode is sponsored by Indeed. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes of this show, booking guests across time zones, tight turnaround edits, and constant time management. And when things get chaotic, you realize pretty quickly how important it is to have the right person on your team. If I had to hire someone tomorrow, I wouldn't just want a good editor. I'd want someone who understands pace in long-form interviews and can work fast under pressure. And in moments like that, you think, this is a job for sponsored jobs. Because Indeed sponsored jobs boost your listing in search results, helping you reach the candidates with the specific skills and experience you actually need. And it works. Sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 95% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs. That's a serious edge when the pressure's on. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. When you need the right person to cut through the chaos, this is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? This is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. Knowing what you know now, what would you tell the 2024 spec Ayo Komatsu in terms of everything you've learned about being a team principal, working with Gene Haas, getting the maximum out of the team? Is there one thing that you would advise that person of 2 years ago?
I don't know. It's difficult because, like I said, I'm learning every day. So I guess just believe in people, trust people, respect each other, be humble, just try to lead by example. You know, it's not always easy. I don't think I behave in the correct manner every day. You know, when I get annoyed about certain things, I'm not proud of certain behavior of mine, but at least I need to try to do it in the right way, and I need to keep improving my behavior, if you like.
But everything you've just said, I think, is exactly why Gene Haas chose you to be the team principal.
Yeah, honestly, like, I have a good relationship with him. I think all we've done, you know, we proved to Gene in the last couple of years that we are actually doing our job with, due diligence, if you like. And so before that, he just didn't have a trust in us because he was asking for certain things. He was demanding certain things, and then it didn't happen. And he didn't understand why. So I'm honestly, from day one, I've been completely transparent with him. And then when he demands certain things, I remember having a conversation with him reasonably earlier on in 24. He told me certain things. I just had to tell him, Gene, we cannot do that, because then I told him why. And then I remember Gene shouting at me saying, but yeah, well, that's not what I want to hear. I said to Gene, like, Gene, I cannot always tell you what you want to hear. You know, what you just told me, I cannot realize it in the time frame that we are talking about. Maybe I can do it in 3 or 4 years' time. There's a lot of things I need to put in place to be able to achieve that. So I cannot promise that in 3 or 6 months' time, whatever the time frame we are talking about. I said it's impossible because we just haven't got process or people or capability to do that. And then to be fair to him, the once he listened to that, it's not like he agreed, oh, okay, I understood, it's fine. But of course, he wasn't happy. But I knew he listened to that because he never mentioned it again. And then in some other conversations I have subsequently, that completely indicated to me that he listened. So for me, he's the owner, right? He started the team. He put all his money into him, invested, not just financially, but he's very, very passionate guy. He's emotionally invested. So, you know, at least I can do is have that transparency and make sure that he understands what we're doing. So that and then just involve him, you know, inform him. He's the owner.
How much contact do you have with Gene?
It's depending on the time of the year, but for instance, race weekend, it's every day.
Every day?
Every day.
Like on the phone or is it a text?
No, on the phone, yeah, because he likes to talk about, you know, hear what's going on. For me, it's easier to explain to him what's going on the phone as well. So Friday night, Saturday night after the race. Sometimes, you know, Sunday after the race, I cannot talk to him straight away, so I talk to him on Monday. But even in between the Bahrain test and now, you know, with all the Middle East conflict and stuff, he's asking me, like, how is it going? Is anything affected? So I keep him informed. But all those ones can be a text. But he's what he's passionate about is the sporting side. So race weekend is a big thing for him. He wants to know what's going on. So yeah, I talk to him every day.
And how important was it that you got him to drive a TPC car at Goodwood last year? Did that change his attitude towards you, towards the team, towards Formula One?
Yeah, I think overall, I think it did. Because what I've seen during 24 was the confirmation that how, you know, he's actually a very, very enthusiastic guy, very passionate guy. But when you see him at the racetrack, you don't necessarily see that. You know, he's a very private individual, very introvert. He doesn't talk to many people. And then, of course, you know, jet lag is quite hard on him as well. So he tends to be quite quiet. And he only talks to people he's comfortable talking with. Then that can be only me or maybe one more person. So maximum three people in the team, right? So people don't actually know him, don't see the exciting side of Jin. And then when we decided like so fast, you know, last year is our 10th season. So I really wanted to celebrate properly, wanted to tell our 10-year story to people, right? So then when I got okay to do that from Jin, the next step for me was to get him over there. I said, look, good to this amazing festival and you got to come and experience this. Then he said, yeah, okay, I'll come, I'll come. Then once I got him to agree to come, my next step was, okay, Jin, by the way, this is your team. You know, you put everything into it. You haven't driven it. Why don't you drive it? So that was my next step. And then he agreed to it, which was brilliant, right? Then because I know he's a passionate guy, right? I really wanted him to enjoy what he's created. So that's the first and foremost. So like, come on, drive it while you can, you know? So that's why I really wanted him to drive. And also then I thought, secondary, for people to see the enjoyment, smile on his face, you know, how much of a passionate guy he is, both internally and externally, I thought that'd be really, really positive. Because lots of team members don't see that, like I said, let alone the fans. It's amazing. So we did a shakedown at Silverstone because he was worried. I said, look, Jin, don't worry, we'll make it as simple as possible. We do a shakedown at Silverstone and then make sure you're comfortable with seat, all the controls and everything else. Then did it. And then when he got out of the car in this Silverstone shakedown, and then he was just beaming with smile and he said thank you to every single mechanics and shook their hand. That never ever happened. Even that alone was for me worthwhile doing because our guys, the guys actually building a car realized, oh, wow, this is Jin, the side of Jin that they've never seen. And then we actually went to Goodwood. And then exactly the same, he was beaming with smile, enjoying it. You know, he had a lot to say about driving the car. And then again, you know, said thank you to everyone, shook hands with everyone. But like when the fans were there, like at Goodwood, as you know, fans can get really close, right? Which is brilliant about Goodwood. I said to Jin, there's fans out there. Do you want to, they want to take some pictures? He'd never ever do that here. Right, race weekend. But he took so many pictures together, so he signed so many autographs, interacted with fans. That's the side of Jin that you don't normally see. Yeah. I was so glad we got that out of him, and then people from our team experienced it, and then fans actually saw it as well. So that was my, let's say, aim. But then, yeah, it's just everything helps, right? You know, I really wanted people to see, like, look, behind this really private guy, quiet guy, introvert guy, this is the, you know, exciting, let's say, enthusiastic side of him. Then for people to see that and experience this, amazing. And also the fact that he spoke with so many mechanics there, right?
Yeah.
When he comes to the racetrack next time, there's more familiar faces, more people that he's comfortable talking with. That's good for him to be integrated more into the team. At the end of the day, right, this is his team. This is what he's created. But he's just such a private guy. If you don't kind of like ask him or get that out of him, he's never going to come by himself to say, I want to do this.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
But that was brilliant. Really good.
I don't rate my chances of getting him on F1 Beyond the Grid, right?
you have to ask
private for that. Look, can we talk about Toyota now?
Yes.
And in the context of Jin, right? He came, he drove at Goodwood. If it needed reinvigorating it, I get the impression that his love of the team and of Formula One was helped by driving the car. Do you think he's as committed to Formula One now as he was when he started the team? Because a lot of people are saying that the Toyota deal is just a precursor to him maybe selling a share of the team? I'd love to get your thoughts.
No, he's more committed than ever.
Really?
Right. Absolutely. I mean, he came into Formula One when the times were very, very different, right? You know, 2016, it was nothing like now. So he came in that more, let's say, I wouldn't say difficult time, but more challenging time. And then he went through that COVID period of 2020 and 2021, came through that, stuck with us. And then now he's enjoying it more. He's enjoying some success. He's just more fun element is there as well as being competitive. And he understands Formula One much more than before. And he's absolutely committed. Yes.
So what about the Toyota deal? What does Toyota bring to Haas?
Yes. So our foundation is Ferrari, right? The way we set up from day one, we couldn't have done it with Ferrari. We don't exist without Ferrari. So we have our power supplied by Ferrari, gearbox and suspension supplied by Ferrari. So Ferrari is our foundation. And then we also have an amazing technical partner in a company called Dallara. You know, so we work together on the chassis side. We now do lots of designs, but Dallara still does a brilliant job in manufacturing. We work all very closely together. So those are, let's say, our foundations, technical partners. But if you look at the areas that Ferrari doesn't touch or cannot touch because of regulation, or the areas that is not Dallara's expertise, there are still plenty of areas that we are just doing it on our own. And we really... I thought it would be really beneficial to have a strong technical partner to help us move forward in those areas that either Ferrari or Dallara is not working with us. So that's where Toyota comes in. So I actually have an amazing partnership with these three greater technical companies.
So what is Toyota bringing? You've now got a TPC program.
See, again, that's one clear advantage, because we always wanted to have a TPC team, because not just running the TPC car, but actually educate people, grow people, and then giving opportunity to younger drivers. That, again, we couldn't do it by ourselves, but thanks to our collaboration with Toyota, we could do that, so that's huge. And also the simulator, we use a simulator in Maranello, but that's logistically, it's quite challenging. So we always wanted to have a simulator in UK, where our main factory is. So we are doing that now. So again, that's thanks to Toyota. So then there's a few other areas that we are working with, but it's great. We're just looking at what Toyota can offer, what Toyota's good at, what our team needs. And then it's those like areas where it's easily identifiable, we're working together.
Are they going to help manufacture any parts?
Yeah, some of the manufacturing, yes.
In Cologne?
Some of it in Cologne, yeah. But again, it's not the objective to say we need to use the Cologne facilities, they need to manufacture. It's more, let's say, organic in the sense that, okay, so Akio-san's direction, Akio-san, by the way, is such a great guy, the chairman of Toyota. His direction to his guys is basically make Haas F1 team competitive. So it's not objective to, in itself, to say, okay, you have to use that Cologne facility, you have to use that facility to manufacture something. No. What do we need to make the Haas F1 team go faster? What areas are we weak? Have we got either people or capability or facility that is able to help in that area from Toyota side? If answer is yes, let's do it together. Like TPC, you know, we wanted to do it, but we just didn't have the financial means or anything to do it. Then Toyota helped us to financially and put the structure in place, etc. And then having that development program.
I mean, Io, when you look at Formula One today,
yeah,
the level is extraordinary.
Yes.
And particularly when you look at the new regulations, yes, in 26, the reliability that everyone's had.
Yeah.
Just wind the clock back 10 years, that wouldn't have happened. The level is so high. Can Haas, with its current setup, challenge the likes of Ferrari, of Mercedes, of Red Bull? Or do you need a fundamental shift? Like, do you need a new factory? Could we ever see you move lock, stock and barrel into the Cologne factory in Germany, Toyota's facility there? Or, I don't know, when you look at the next 5 years, what does Haas need to do and what needs to happen for you guys to be able to challenge for wins, let's say?
Yeah, definitely we need to be constantly evolving. And then for me to sit here and talk about the wins is too far away, for sure. So our medium-term target in the next 3 to 5 years is basically trying to establish ourselves consistently at the front of the midfield pack, right? That's where we need to be year in, year out on the merit, not because some team didn't do a very good job. You know, on the merit, everyone's doing amazing job. We need to be at the front of midfield consistently in a 3 to 4 years time. That's our aim. And then from that aim, of course, you work backwards what this organization needs to be, how it needs to evolve, how quickly it needs to evolve. So that's what we're doing. But then for me, only when you get there in a 3 to 5 years time, then we can look at, okay, what are we still lacking to challenge for podiums on the merit, to challenge for the race wins on the merit? There's, of course, a big gap. You know, big four teams are big four teams. But it's not everything about the size. But again, it's not to say we just need to increase the numbers of people, or not to say we need to manufacture everything internally. That's not the answer, right? But we got to look at where we are in, let's say, 3 to 5 years' time. Once we establish ourselves front of the midfield consistently year in, year out, I'm sure it will become actually obvious what gap we need to bridge to be able to challenge for podiums.
Do you have any idea sitting here now what that might look like?
Yeah, but I don't think it's very relevant in the sense, I think you got to have a broad idea, but like, you know, I say, like, objectives, yes, definitely got to have a long-term objectives, right? Let's say you have a 10-year plan, but for me, it's no point having such a concrete plan 5 years beyond, year 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Why? Because what you need to do on the year 5, year 6 is heavily influenced by year 3 or year 2. So every day you make some adjustment, then but the year 2, year 3, year 4, you can still have a reasonably concrete plan. Then you can make adjustment. But what we need to do in year 7, for example, because it's so far away, depending on the direction we took, the steps we take on the year 2, year 3, this will change a lot. So sure. You got to have a broad plan, but it's just no point for me to have that concrete plan.
Can we talk drivers?
Sure.
You, first of all. How did you enjoy driving?
I was very, very cautious. Again, to start off, is what a privilege. You know, it's not every day.
I should just add, though, that you drove with Gene at Goodwood. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, sure. No, it's not every day that you get to drive a Formula One car, right?
So was it the first time for you?
Of course.
Yeah.
It was incredible. But I just had to drive very, very cautiously. But the thing is, like, thanks to some of my driver/riders friends, they all scared hell out of me, saying, good, this is the most dangerous place. It's such a low grip. If you go off, you know, you can really damage the car. And then, like, again, even, who was it? Yeah, Kazuki Nakajima, ex-F1 driver. He was telling me how slow I need to drive to be absolutely safe, because he showed me a video of, I think it was a Pierre Gasly driving Alpine or something, and then looks very slow, and said, yeah, but Ayao-san, even a professional driver has to drive this slow, so you got to be really, really careful. So I was, like, really worried about it. And then the first drive, and that's it. Actually, grip is fine, but then because you never know, right? I just drove very slow and came back, and then bumped into John in the toilet. I said, "How was it, John?" And then John said, the best grip ever made. It's such a great country. Thanks, John. I just wasted one run because I listened to your scaremonger history story.
By the way, I love the fact that you and John McGuinness, the Isle of Man TT legend, are mates. how do you know John?
I love motorbikes, right? And then sad thing is I haven't been to Isle of Man, but my kids been twice. But because I obviously got a minor thing called Canadian Grand Prix that used to coincide with Isle of Man, I never made it. But John is such a great guy, humble, down-to-earth guy, eats for English breakfast. It's so funny. but then he's, he's got Betty, but he's an amazing rider, right? Amazing
are you
guy.
A rider? Are you a biker?
I used to ride bikes when I was young. I was terrible, absolutely terrible. I crashed so many times.
But sorry, on track or we just...
No. I was nowhere near good enough to ride on the track. I crashed so many times on the road. So no. Motorbike for me, I never felt in one with motorbikes. But then somebody like John, you know, I said to him, he's just incredible. And I can't remember how old he is now, but I remember talking to him. Was it last year? He was doing still PBs at his age. Ironman. You know, places where you get scratches on your helmet. It's absolutely crazy, like the commitment. But he loves it. You know, he really, really enjoys it. He's just a genuine guy.
Yeah. This episode is sponsored by Indeed. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes of this show, booking guests across time zones, tight turnaround edits, and constant time management. And when things get chaotic, you realize pretty quickly how important it is to have the right person on your team. If I had to hire someone tomorrow, I wouldn't just want a good editor. I'd want someone who understands pace in long-form interviews and can work fast under pressure. And in moments like that, you think, this is a job for sponsored jobs. Because Indeed sponsored jobs boost your listing in search results, helping you reach the candidates with the specific skills and experience you actually need. And it works. Sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 95% more likely to report a hire than non-sponsored jobs. That's a serious edge when the pressure's on. Spend less time searching and more time actually interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. When you need the right person to cut through the chaos, this is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? This is a job for Indeed sponsored jobs. Cadillac has entered Formula One, deepening the racing pedigree behind every V-Series on the road. Discover a lineup that delivers pure adrenaline in the form of modern luxury. Experience the quickest Cadillac ever, the all-electric Lyriq V, the peak performance of the CT5V Blackwing, the nimble agility of the Optiq V, and the legendary roar of the Escalade V, all engineered to thrill. Find out more about Cadillac's performance story in Formula One and our race-tested V-Series lineup at Cadillac.com.
Well, look, what about the race drivers?
Right.
Oli Behrmann, Esteban Ocon. Let's throw it back to 25, first of all. The job they did for you last year, two drivers at very different stages of their Formula One careers, aren't they? Let's start with Esteban.
Yeah. The reason we signed Esteban, I wanted Esteban was his work ethic, right? And he's clearly very, very fast when he has the car he likes. You know, he's a proven quality race winner, podium finisher, scored so many points over the last 10 years. And I know that he doesn't leave any stones unturned. And as a team to grow, somebody like that is what I needed. And I knew that we are signing Oli Behrmann, which is an exciting rookie. So I really needed somebody with experience, but still young enough and really hungry for success. And then Esteban was the one. So that's why I signed him. And then especially earlier in the season, he was doing really, really well. But again, you know, from that moment in Melbourne, he gave us the data, he gave us the feedback we needed to make basically a decision how we're going to, let's say, modify the car for Suzuka, right? So he played a pivotal role in that. And also Shanghai, he drove really, really well and scored points for us. So when he's got the car, or even Melbourne, of course, he didn't have the car, but he was very, very good at giving us feedback. And then when the car was much better in Shanghai, it's the same car, but it's just because the truck hasn't got the input to provoke these dynamics. So car was behaving okay. At that instance, Esteban was brilliant, right? Then scored our first points of the season. Again, Monaco was another highlight earlier in the season. But then at some point, we had too many issues with the brakes that we couldn't totally identify. So he was struggling with that. And then when he is not confident under braking, he just cannot push enough. You know, he cannot drive around it. That's his driving style. That's his mentality. So certain, let's say, races, we just couldn't get the performance out of the car, performance out of him. Like Baku was the one bad example. He really wasn't confident with brakes and we couldn't solve it. Then that meant he was so far off the pace. But it's amazing. You know, it's a obviously, driving a Formula One car, being a Formula One driver is a very, very sensitive thing. Like, look at Abu Dhabi, great example. Friday, he wasn't happy with brakes again, completely off the pace, like half a second. And then we changed a few things overnight, but nothing that obviously indicates us to say like, oh, Friday, this was the problem. Certain setup changes, certain, let's say, component changes. Again, when we look at the data, nothing's night and day. But for Esteban, FP3 was totally clear. His feeling was great with the car. He had no issues that he felt on Friday. And then bang, he was on the pace straight away. Same pace as Oli Behrmann. right? So that half a second, we're not talking about tens or two, half a second he was missing on Friday. He just got there. So he's got it. It's just about how to unlock it, how we can give him a car that give him that confidence to push to that limit.
On the brakes in particular?
Lots of it was on brakes, yeah. Whenever he was really struggling qualifying, that was brakes. Because in a race, you don't brake as hard, so the problem becomes smaller. But in a qualifying way, you have to put everything on the line, late braking, peak pressure. That's where he had a problem.
I'm going to take you back to a quote that I read. Unfortunately, right. I wasn't at the press conference that you gave in the Bahrain test. So right. Forgive me if this has been taken out of context. Sure. I don't know. But you said you expected more from Esteban last year. What did you mean by that, given everything you've just said?
Yeah, I don't think that was a press conference in Bahrain. That was, I think, after Barcelona when I did...
After the shakedown.
Yeah, after right. the shakedown when I did a online media session. I think that was completely taken out of context anyway, because I basically, if you listen to the whole sentence, it was much more in the context of the overall picture. But what I meant by we expected much more from Esteban, of course, you know, he's a race winner. He finished on the podium. He scored so many points before, 10 years of experience in Formula One. I expected him to score more points than Ollie Bearman. I'm sure he expected the same. You know, that's what should have happened, but it didn't. Why? Because part of it, he couldn't get on with the car at certain races. Part of it, the team couldn't give him the car to give that confidence. So I wasn't blaming him. It's all a team effort. But, you know, for whatever the reason, which we still don't totally understand, because that Abu Dhabi thing, the prime example, Friday to Saturday, from what we can see, it's not a night and day difference in the car performance. But whatever it is, gave Esteban that confidence that he needed to perform, right? So result was night and day. So as a team, we need to be able to put Esteban in that situation at every race, every session, right? But we are not good enough to do that last year. So this year, we need to be.
Do you think the 2026 cars being 30-odd kilos lighter will sort of lend themselves more to Esteban's driving style?
I don't think so. Honestly, I think Esteban's a very good driver. So, you know, whether cars 30 kilo heavier, 30 kilo lighter, you know, if he's got the confidence, if he's got good feel on the car, he can get best out of both cars. It's not a problem. So, but it's just about, again, we talked about process that we're still learning. We talked about the younger truck side team. So we are all learning together. You know, everybody needs different things. But the good thing is we are able to talk about these things in a completely open, transparent manner, constructive manner. And then, like I said before, you got to be able to have hard conversations. And we've been having that throughout the last season. Not to have a go at each other, but without having those hard conversations, you cannot get to the bottom of the root cause, bottom of the issue. And then if you don't get to the root cause, you cannot solve it, right? So you got to put everything on the table in a manner such that you don't take it personally. Sometimes it's difficult, but you try your best. And then once you put everything on the table, then at least that's the start that you can have a chance to solve it.
Okay, right. That's Esteban.
Yeah.
What about Ollie Bearman? How did he evolve as a driver during his first full season in Formula One?
No, it was great to see him evolve in that way, actually. You know, again, before when we signing Ollie, right, lots of people asked me, like, but having had a good history about rookie drivers, is your team capable of, you know, developing a rookie driver? I said, come on, you know, you cannot bundle rookie driver as one. You got to look at individuals. I had no doubt Ollie Bearman, he had an amazing, amazing talent and potential. So, and then I had the confidence that if we do it right, I knew we could do it, that we can develop him, we can nurture the talent, etc. So I had no doubt. But then beginning of the season, again, unsurprisingly, he showed his brilliance in the speed, but he made some mistakes, rookie mistakes, silly mistakes. But then again, going back to having hard conversation, you got to have those conversations, then set the expectation, right? Why do we make those mistakes? Why did you make that, you know, mistake or decision, wrong decision at those critical moments or non-critical moments? So you got to be able to discuss those things and understand how we can do better in terms of his preparation, mental preparation, or how can teams help? How, you know, we work with his management closely as well. How can we give him better mindset, framework, short-term objectives? How can we get him to focus more on the right things, take the noise out, environment, create an environment. So it's a huge team effort. Like that Monaco, you know, overtaking under red flag, get 10 place grip penalty. Get 10 place grip penalty in Monaco when we had a decent car and he's quick. It's a disaster, but you got to learn from it. Then Silverstone, the same thing. Car was good, and then a red flag, pit lane entry, crash, right?
But it seems you had upgrades as well, I think, at that race, didn't you?
Sorry?
You had upgrades on the car.
No, the upgrade was working, right? Yeah. So the car was fast, and Oli was fast. Oli got on with that upgrade really well straight away. So yeah, we had huge potential. And then, of course, that went down the drain when he crashed in the pit lane. Those moments, you got to raise up from it as a team, group of people together, Oli included. All his management team, everyone included. And we've done that. Then you started seeing the result of it towards the end of the season. And his consistency of delivery got much, much better. He was much more focused. He took the noise out of his environment. And then it's just amazing rate of improvement. Then probably the pinnacle you saw was that Mexico. You know, that doesn't happen by chance. You know, the way Oli drove on that day, with huge pressure from people like George, Piastri, or even Max. And then it didn't look like he had pressure. Of course he had pressure, but he drove in that amazing manner. That doesn't happen by chance. It's accumulation of all the hard work that happened last months.
It was an incredible journey that he went on last year. I mean, let's talk about Melbourne again.
Yeah.
I mean, the car was difficult. We've established that over the course of our chat now, but you know, he crashed in two of the three practice sessions and then look at the performance he did in Mexico. It's like a different driver almost.
Yeah. Thanks for reminding me about that.
Sorry.
Yeah, Melbourne, like so you can see straight away, we had a huge problem in the car with the car, right? And then he had a heavy crash. So he didn't run on Friday. And I remember having a conversation with him on Friday night. Look, Oli, we need you tomorrow morning because we only got Esteban's feedback so far. But, you know, in high speed corners, I really need to have, the team really needs to have both drivers' feedback because Esteban and Oli, you know, those guys, how he feels on the high speed dynamics is slightly different. So, you know, for Esteban, this is a big problem. I really need your feedback. Then what does he do in FP3? He shunted straight away. I was mad, right? but then I had to then calm myself down, take that emotion out of the way, then have a strong, hard, but constructive conversation with himself, right? Which we did.
And how does he react to that?
Good. But this is the amazing thing about that kid. Okay, he's 20, so maybe I cannot call him kid. He's less than half my age. But no, he's those tough moments, of course, you know, he's really disappointed. He's gutted. He's like destroyed. But when we have those conversations, he's very, very open. He listens. Even if he doesn't agree, at least he listens. You know, so that is a quality that I noticed very, very early on. If you are able to listen, you know, digest the information coming from other parties, whether you agree or not, whether you like it or not, you know, that is gives you a chance to improve, right? And then I remember talking to him in Shanghai start of the weekend. I said to him, look, I don't care about lap time here this weekend in Shanghai because I know you are quick. But this weekend, if you are, let's say, 3/10 of Esteban all weekend, I said, I do not care because I don't doubt your speed, but you got to do every single lap that is on the run program. That's all I care. And he said, okay. He got on with it, did every single lap on the program. What was the result? Scored points. So for me, the focus was different. But of course, you know, he's incredibly talented and quick, right? Do you remember in 24, when he stood in for Kevin Magnussen in Brazil. So Brazil is a very, very technical track, right? I love the track because it's so challenging, but for a driver, it's very challenging. And he had no simulator session or anything. I told him, I think like at 6 o'clock in the morning, Kevin's not well, can you jump in the car? No preparation. Then that was sprint weekend. So he had 1 hour to prepare for sprint qualifying. And then I remember watching FP1, run one, lap one, yeah? Without any preparation. That lap he did, I never forget. I was like, how can you do that? You just woke up, been told you're driving, got in the car, spoke with engineers, go out of the garage, out lap, then one push lap. Whoa. So he's got that natural ability to be able to do that. But that's such a knife edge. That's not so different from having that crash in Melbourne last year here in FP1. FP3 one was different, but FP1. So again, when you take risk, that Brazil, probably he had to take that risk. But that was well judged. But Melbourne wasn't. And even when he drove for Ferrari in Jeddah, you know, that famous race that he stood in for Carlos and then got P7, I think qualifying, I can't remember, you know, I remember watching on board, he touched the wall a few times, right? So he's always there. But it's just such a small difference between hero or completely the failure. But you got to manage that. You got to understand when you take the risks, right? To take the risks is not FP1 or even Q1, depending on the car, right? Q3, if he crashed because he pushed, you can't blame him. That's when you have to take the risk. But just to judging that.
But that's experience, isn't it?
Exactly.
I mean, look at Max Verstappen was exactly as you've just described in his early years. And then look at him now.
But this is why, you know, like I don't complain in the sense that, you know, I'd rather work with somebody who's got that unbelievable potential. And he's got the personality, like I said, the openness and then genuineness, the humbleness to be able to have those conversations and listen. So, no, I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoy working with him.
How good can Ollie Bearman get?
I don't know. I haven't seen the limit yet. So I'm really looking forward to this year. He's again stepped up already with the brand new regulation complications. He needs to work with engineers, not on the chassis side, but on the power unit side. So I think for somebody like him, you know, every year he's been doing different formula. And compared to last year to this year, yes, it's both Formula One, but changes are so big. It's like might as well be a different championship, right? But it's not new to him. You know, it's another new year, another new category. Here we go. So he's got huge, huge potential.
Do you worry that you might lose him to Ferrari one day?
Yeah, it's no point worrying about it. You know, I'm a strong believer in controlling what you can control. And then whether, you know, Ferrari's been investing in him for many, many years. So we got him, you know, for last year and of course this year. So we got to focus on what we can control. And then if we've done great job with Ollie, and then Ollie performed so well that Ferrari really wants to take him the following year, we have to be happy that we've done our job, if you like. So you got to focus on your job.
Are there any deadlines in this year when you need to know from Ferrari what their plans are?
Yeah, but that'd be just a discussion between us and Ferrari. Sure. But seriously, I'm just we all are just focused on getting best performance out of the car and out of body. If that meant like we lost him for next year, hopefully not, but that's not something we can control.
It's been so great having you on the podcast again, Ayo. Thank you. I love our chats. So look, what does success look like for Haas this year? I think you may have alluded to it already, front of the midfield, or what do you hope for in 26?
For me, it's again, continuous improvement, you know, just learning from mistakes, improving from last year, improving from last race. You know, in terms of championship position, you cannot judge everything by championship position, right? Because so 24, we finished P7, and then 25, we finished P8. You know, our target was P6, but 25 overall, I think there was a lots of positive. We scored 79 points in that tight midfield where 1,000 of a second defines if you can go into Q3 or not. To be able to be fighting there in that sense, scoring 79 points, a huge improvement. But this year, again, with brand new regulation, who knows? People will improve. You know, some people will make a big improvement. Some people may struggle to make more improvements. So that landscape will be different. So championship, I cannot say what the success looks like in terms of championship position, but in terms of as a team, I think we are growing in the right way. And then this is a huge challenge. And so far what I've seen, you know, through the, you know, Barcelona shakedown to Bahrain test and the preparation before that, we've been doing reasonably well, you know, especially considering our organization. And then we pushed like hell last year for 25 cars. So we are doing parallel development. And then so I actually prepared myself, my team, for a lot worse right now. So we are, I would say we are in a better shape than I prepared myself for, prepared our team for. But again, there's no complacency, right? You got to really focus on basics, execute. And then at least I'd like to see us getting more out of the car, best out of the car, more consistently. In terms of track side, that would be a clear sign of success. At the base, in terms of development, again, this year is going to be a huge, huge development race. And that's going to be tougher than last 4 years. But if we can keep up with that development race, that would be a success.
Well, best of luck, Ion.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. Cheers. Pleasure.
What a fascinating conversation with Io. He's so logical in his explanations and so reassuring in his analysis. What an inspiring leader he is. And I loved what he said about the drivers and Ollie Bearman in particular. Io hasn't seen Ollie's limit yet, which is a mouthwatering prospect for all of us neutrals and for Ferrari, who have him on a bungee back to the team. And remember that Io has worked with a lot of drivers, so this is praise indeed for Ollie. Io San, thank you for your time. It was great to chat. Well, that's almost it for this week's show. A few parish notices before I go. F1 Nation's preview of this weekend's Japanese Grand Prix is out now. I'm joined by Jolyon Palmer and James Hinchcliffe. Just search F1 Nation on your podcast app, or you can watch our chat on the F1 YouTube channel. And this week's episode of F1 Explains answers your questions on the new 2026 tyres. That'll be on the F1 Nation feed this week. Thanks very much for listening. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.